I'm really excited and slightly anxious to announce that my book, The Autistic Burnout Workbook, is releasing this next week. It comes out March 11th. It's available for pre-order right now. I am trying to avoid falling back into burnout. When you release a book, there is a lot of pressure to do promotion and to market and to get the word out there. So this is my burnout prevention form of marketing. I'm running a special right now for those who are supporting my work through pre-ordering. You can submit that information after you pre-order, and we will get you a coupon code that you can use toward our store for the same amount. So the workbook costs $18.99. So then you'd get $18.99 to use in our digital shop or in our Etsy shop, which would get you another digital workbook for free. So you buy one workbook and then you get a digital one for free. That is the promotion I'm running. It's technically a pre-order promotion, but I've been a bit behind on getting the word out. So for listeners of the podcast, I'm going to extend that. If you buy the book in the next month, you can go ahead and redeem the special. The link for that is in the notes below. Thank you so much for supporting my work. It means so much to me, and I just really appreciate you and hope that you will find this a helpful resource for you as you continue to build a life that is a bit more resilient to autistic burnout.
Hey, everyone. You are listening to the Divergent Conversations podcast. We are two neurodivergent mental health professionals in a neurotypical world. I'm Patrick Cassell.
And I'm Dr. Neff.
And during these episodes, we do talk about sensitive subjects, mental health, and there are some conversations that can certainly feel a bit overwhelming. So we do just want to use that disclosure and disclaimer before jumping in. And thanks for listening.
Am I opening us today, Patrick? I think I am. You're on mute. Hi.
This is always the moment where I like look at Megan. Megan looks at me. I'm like, Megan, we just said you were going to introduce the guest. And then Megan looks back at me and smiles. And I'm like,
you could flip it around and I can introduce you too.
Yeah, Brett can just introduce himself. No, welcome. Does it? Welcome to the first. That would be amazing. No, I feel like it's like the hot potato. I always feel like this in a group conversation, like, and I'm always, if I have the hot potato, it's like, okay, how do I pass it to someone else? I don't want the hot potato. Okay, so I have the hot potato. I'm introducing Brett today. I'm so excited for this conversation. Brett, I just asked you, Mally.
Yeah, you got it. Yeah.
Yes. Brett Mally. So, I don't really do formal bios very well. I like to share the context of how I came to know you. So I'll share that. And then if there's other pertinent things to share about your context, please do. We met because actually someone in my community linked to your documentary and they were like, Dr. Neff, I think you'd be great for this. You should reach out to them. And I reached out to you and you emailed right away. And I learned about your documentary you're making about autism, and it's beautiful. And I got so excited, and we've kind of done some collaboration around your upcoming documentary. But I also went to your website and learned that you're like a very creative photographer, artist, late diagnosed adult parent like me. And so bringing you on to talk about, we're doing a mini series on what is autism. So bringing you on today to talk about autism and creativity just felt like a really natural extension of the work you're doing in the world. And you're a professor at PSU here in Oregon.
Or Chemeketa, but yes.
Chemeketa, yes. I knew that. See, this is why I shouldn't go too far into bios. What else? What other context pieces did I miss about who you are?
You hit it. I'm just a creative, late diagnosed that found a way to talk about my special interests and info dump to people that are literally sitting there captivated and to go to school for this stuff. So it makes sense. So on the creative side, I'm an author for Adobe Press, Peach Pit and Pearson for Adobe compositing, right? Photoshop compositing. I minored in electronic music. So I do music composition, and I, anything creative, I love doing. Helping my son with all of his creative endeavors that he doesn't have, the skills or technique for things. I'm like, oh, we can do that, and so being a creative father also is, I guess, an aspect of my creativity as well.
Oh, I love that, like applying it to parenting, being the creative father. I love that idea of assigning creativity to roles and like how we show up in the roles we occupy.
Yeah. Huh.
Hey, Brian.
So you,
before Megan jumps in, we should have started recording and Megan asked you, like, you started going into the origin story of your last name. And I thought that was like a very autistic response. So do you want to share that too?
Sure. Yeah. No, it's everything. So my, here we go. Here's an autistic response to describing an autistic response here. So this fall is when I got my diagnosis. And so now me talking in spirals, everything makes more sense. And so now I'm recognizing of, yes, I do get to that point, but I'm going to take people on a journey. Megan, Anna, when you asked about, how do you pronounce your last name? Mali, and it actually, well, my grandfather came from Syria to go to school in the US and they needed, something that sounded more, American, and because of discrimination and a number of, you know, things at the time. And so they settled on Mali, which sounded close enough to, which was, salt in Arabic, and how that was pronounced in Arabic. They're like, okay, this is close enough. And so now Mali, and since I look so, and am so white, so Caucasian, people like, oh, it's just Irish, you're O'Malley. I'm like, sure. Yeah. So there's the answer. Mali came from, yeah.
Can I ask, cause I can like articulate this from my experience. I'm curious for both of you. For me, like I was doing something similar. I was in a call with someone we're meeting. They're an ADHD or not autistic. And it was my first time meeting with them. And I felt like I kept name dropping. But what I was doing is if I was going to introduce an idea, I had to share the context where the idea came from. Cause I can't just be like, oh, there's this idea. It's like, well, I was talking to this person. And then halfway through, I'm like, oh my gosh, it sounds like I'm name dropping right now, but I'm wanting to share the context of the idea. Cause ideas live in context.
Yeah. That's
so like,
right.
For you, is it like your last name? It's like, well, yeah, but it lives in this context of like everything you just shared.
Yeah, it's every, this is all maybe part of the creativity thing, but everything feels like it has its own little story, its own little journey. This is side tangent, but we're trying to get my mom to come up here and she's building a house next to us. And so in her working with a builder, describing the door she wants, she'll give a whole journey of the why. And they're like, no, we just, how many doors? And she can't. And so it's relatable and accommodated within our family, because that's always kind of how we've journeyed in talking about things with these stories of context. So
I know we are going to talk about your documentary, because I think that's a big part of creativity. And I listened to it the other day where there was like a Samwise Gamgee reference, I think Lord of the Rings style. Any chance your mom decided to choose a door that looked like Hobbit Hole-esque? That would be really cool.
So, yeah. So obviously, my family, you know, steeped in lots of fantasy, Lord of the Rings, all of that. And I'm a fantasy fiction. The Hobbit aesthetic is, you have no idea how close to the aesthetic of my mother that all of that is. So the most that she can get the builders to do is at least a Dutch door that's going to be custom. So it's going to have, she has stairs right now in her little cabin in the woods that are like staggered. They're not just stairs because it's too steep. And so everything is, quite fantastical. There's a name for it, dopo decor, for literally you surround yourself in these things that make you feel good as you're looking around things. Hmm. And that's,
like dopamine, decor.
Yeah. I think I'm saying that right.
I've never heard that before. I love it.
Yeah, she looked it up. She's like, oh, that's literally my thing. Yeah. I have a pitchfork from my great grandmother from, on the wall, and all these things that for her really make her feel good, like plants and things. So.
Yeah. I mean, look behind me. That's my entire existence. And I don't know if I was reading Megan's face accurately, because I saw you smiling like as he was speaking, and I was like, oh man, I'm getting so excited about this Lord of the Rings thing and I don't want to diverge too much. I did meet the actor who played Sauron in Lord of the Rings, by the way. Had brunch with him. went out to drinks with him in Portugal. It was amazing. Anyway, circling back, context, Megan, what you were just saying, it happened to me last night. So I was out with my wife for dinner. I started telling a story about we're hiring one of our interns. And really the context was like, I'm so excited about how people who are interning at our group practice are staying on to work full time. But I just led with like, we're hiring an intern and that's really cool. And she was like, why are you telling me this? And I was like, okay, context. The context is, this is really exciting to me that people who are interning with us feel so supported that they want to stay. And she was like, next time start with that. I'm like, I never will. That will never happen.
Like, how will my brain know to start there?
I'll get there. But how do I know to start there? That's the real question. Anyway, let's carry on.
Well, I love that because, you know, and teaching at the college level, I can, and this is expected that you give yourself an outline, but it doesn't need to be a verbatim thing. You can just kind of let it flow. And so I've again, found this career where I know what I'm going to talk about every single time that I do this lecture. It is going to be different and I'll take students on a slightly different journey. We'll get the content, but maybe it's because the class there, you know, the audience also changes it too. So it changes where I know that there might be something funny if it's a class that really kind of needs that to relieve tension or other things. So I don't know, context and then also who you're sharing with, at least for me, it changes how it comes out each time too.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think one element of creativity is that it's often co-created and like that's what makes a spark. Like Patrick and I were just talking about the kinds of guests that we like having on and want to have more on. I'm not sure if I should be saying this out loud, but we're talking about how important like play is, like playful people where we can enter that space of, I think, co-created creativity. And I think that's part of what you're describing in the classroom is a co-created creativity of like being able to kind of spark off each other's energy in that way.
You're riffing.
When people hire me for speaking events, I don't plan anything out. I'm just feeding off of the energy the audience is giving me. And people will ask me like, can you teach me how to do this thing? And I'm like, I really can't. Like, I really don't know how to teach you this because I'm literally just going up there with this idea in my mind and we're just going to see where it goes. And for so many people, that is so counterintuitive to like any sort of process that they may have. And I love it. I mean, I thrive off of it. Megan's getting
my anxiety in my body is just I have nightmares about that, like going up on stage or a presentation and not knowing what I'm going to say. I'm practicing it. Like I am doing more speaking now and I'm practicing going in unscripted, but I hadn't made this connection till just now, till we're talking about the context piece. I knew I was someone who scripted a ton, a ton. Every time I had a very different experience in the classroom, Brett, I would know exactly what I said. I would have run through my slides several times. And I think it's because I do go on so many like context rabbit trails.
Yeah.
And then I'd be like, oh my gosh, this is ridiculous. And not to the point at all that I would script to like rein it in. Otherwise my mind will be all over the place. I do the opposite. I script. I'm practicing not.
Literally getting like shrinking into your screen, like just like uncomfortable when I was talking.
Well, it really sounds like my worst nightmare to like not just know what I'm going to say.
Here's an in-between because there's a flip side of when Megan added that I find that is way more helpful. And that's when I have an audience or a class and for whatever reason, just the configuration of personalities and things. And it is, I get nothing and I cannot read anything. I can't pick up on any. And when it's that flat, having a script would be so, so helpful. So I think for me, when I know the content enough, like forwards and backwards, it's just who I am. And I get to share what I'm very excited about. Then I can let my excitement sort of navigate. And then I'm just excited. I get to talk to people that are also interested in this. But if I don't get any feeling like, oh, they I go straight to, oh, they hate the subject and they hate me and what am I doing here? And boy, I wish I had a script. So I could imagine for those moments of when that kind of anxiety kicks in that, I could see the benefit of both for me, depending on either kind of situation.
It's amazing what one validating head nod can do while you're presenting. You're like, oh, okay, let me feed off that. But if you just see blank stares at you, it's like, oh shit.
I can't. I start oversharing and what am I talking about? This other thing.
Usually afterwards people will come up to me like, that was really great. And you're like, it was? Like what's happening here?
And did you nod? I find myself in the audience. I don't know. Again, we're getting off there, but nodding because I know that I so appreciate that. And so I look around everyone. You know, no silhouettes are moving. And here's me. I'm like rocking out. I'm like, this is what I would want. And I realized that, you know, back to my mom, is she gave so much of that energy of just like, yeah, we're talking about Hobbit stories, you know, or whatever it is. And we would just really get that over-expressive, perspective-wise of who you're saying that to. I don't know, response. And then that made it so more comfortable to know exactly where the person is. So yeah, I fully agree.
I'm with you. I think especially after if you've been a teacher or a presenter, I think it makes you like participate differently. And when you think like no one can tell you're on your phone, like no, we can tell. Like, and you don't really realize that until you're a teacher or presenter. It's like it's obvious. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
Yeah. Teaching at Schmeckeda, we have a lot of neurodivergent students and that are talking more about autism, ADHD. So when, you know, it's time to present or do these more sort of traditional, you know, college kind of things in the classroom, really making sure that it's broken down and that they get the support that, I wish I had there. So it's helpful to know it kind of from both sides and to be that support for others. You know, just working through and fostering those kinds of really supportive environments, I think is, you know, empathetic environments are so crucial, I think, for learning also. And creativity, because bringing it back to the topic here, that's another really vulnerable topic in a lot of ways. You're sharing very personal things. And so whether you're giving a presentation or you're showing your artwork, that's putting a piece of yourself out there in some way. And so it all relates for sure.
Okay, let's pick that up. It's putting yourself out there in a specific way. Because I think I'm so fascinated by this idea of creativity and neurodivergence. Because I think something I say a lot, I talk a lot about alexithymia and emotional expression. And something I say a lot is I think a lot of us need alternative mediums to express our inner world or access our inner world. And I think creativity, whether it's art, poetry, music, I think this is a medium that works for a lot of us. So yeah, I guess I'm curious to know more. I mean, you've have a long history of creativity. Autism is newer to you, as in knowing about it, but like what role has creativity played in your life, played in your self-expression? I realize that's a really big, broad, big question. I apologize.
No, it's good. I'll try to keep my spiral a little tighter. Let's see. But I have to go back to my school. So I went to a Waldorf school that is basically, I mean, if I was being very reductive, it's a hippie art school, right? The one that I went to in the countryside. And so creativity is literally intrinsic to who I am and experience and what I think about and what I did. It's just what I breathe. I want to, even if it's problem solving, it's all creative based. And so at the school, I was accommodated for, you know, always needing to draw, always needing, you know, that was just part of the lesson. Whereas, you know, for my son and his creativity, the way that he imagines that was not a good fit. So for me, that really fostered just a sense of, oh, I can just make and that's who I am. So much so that by the time I went to high school, just the public high school, by the end of high school, I was, you know, they have the voted most blah, blah, blah. I was voted most artistic. I think they maybe got confused there. Artistic for... even though I never took a art class. And so all the art teachers are like, who is this guy? At the very end, I took a photography class and I think every time that I got more exposure, it opened up this avenue of expression and joy when something comes out. For me, whether it was photography and the alchemy of being in the dark room and something that I made is there, and something about that is so powerful. And before that, it was poetry. Sorry, I hit the mic there. And then, you know, photography and filmmaking and music. For me, it all comes from this exact same seed, even though they're all completely different. That feeling of making, and then it's out there and you listen to it, and there's just this, I don't know, this connection that is pure joy. When you get something that you're okay with, when you say when to say when on it, if I can listen to it again or look at the image again or watch something again, and I get those same feels that I did while making it, then I know I'm like, oh, I got something. So I don't even know if I got to the point there, but excuse me, the overall journey started from when I was very, very little. And it's just always been part of who I am. It's just a maker.
Can I drop something kind of nerdy? I mean, I don't know why I'm asking permission for that. That's interesting. So I was a sociology major, and I actually really loved learning about Karl Marx's like theory. Like, obviously, we have a lot of ideas of what Karl Marx stood for, but at the core of his theory was this idea of alienation of human nature. And so one of the things that he was talking about was, you know, we go from this economy where we are the makers. Like, I'm woodworking, I'm making this chair, and or I am like in my farm, I am making it, I'm making it with my neighbors. And what we do when we make and we create is it's an expression of our human nature. Hmm. And then with modernity, what happened is we started selling our labor, right? So then we go to the shop and we're on a conveyor belt. That's not the word for it, but
assembly line. Yeah.
Assembly line. And we become disconnected from our labor because we're selling it as a product, and we're no longer expressing our humanness through our labor. This idea has, I don't know why. I mean, I learned it when I was like 20, and it has just stuck with me of we express our human nature through what we create. And that's something that in modern society, a lot of us have become disconnected from. And so I loved what you talk about with making, that you're expressing who you are through what you create, and how powerful that is, how healing that is, how connected to agency that is. So yeah, that's my nerdy association for today. Yeah.
Well, and bring it back to Lord of the Rings, Patrick, you know, so much of my imagination, my world is steeped in fantasy. You know, I don't think I really read, also dyslexic here, until later, and didn't find the joy of reading until Robert Jordan and then Brandon Sanderson and so forth for The Wheel of Time. And then that's when it struck. But the imagery of all of that, of the glowing, you know, lights and just these fantastical forests. I grew up outside of Yosemite. So sort of the epic natures and scenes has also been infused with, you know, how do I recreate what I feel, you know, nature kind of represents in this over, you know, it's wonderfully fantastical version. So, you know, fusing that in through my art, throughout has been just what I do. And so, you know, whether it's, you know, very, you know, classic fiction fantasy, or just someone's floating, right, or making their cat float in the air or something. It's just, you know, being more than the everyday has been important to capture of what I feel and think about in environments, and then to represent and share with others, bring other people into my mind photography, right? And that's what, bringing back to compositing specifically, that's what that was. I can take my pictures and I can say, okay, I know I'm going to need a leaf in a corner, so that picture will be good. And I can do this collage, this of all these puzzle pieces to create the scene that I can bring everybody else into, right, that I could imagine. It's just, that's, Photoshop was really very fun in that way.
I noticed that about your photography when I looked at it, because like people floating, and it, you ask what if, like there's a magical element to it, of like what is possible. Yeah. Dr. Dalton is someone's work I really like. He joined me for a master class on anxiety and talking about anxiety and anxiety and autism specifically, something he says that I love is that anxiety and creativity are the flip side of the same coin because they both ask what if.
I can relate to that big time because I feel like as someone who is just anxious all the time, it feels very similar to when I am being creative in a different way. And like Brett, like you mentioned, when we're putting our creations out into the world, there is a vulnerability there. And it creates even some anxiety in terms of like, how is this going to be received, right? If Megan and I did a mini series on RSD and how RSD shows up when we're being creative sometimes of like, how's the world going to critique this or pick this apart or offer feedback? And that can be really intimidating.
Especially if it's us, like if we're putting us out there, if we are, if it's an expression of us and then it's being critiqued, it's painful.
So I have some wonderful and terrible horror stories with this. So going to, I have the opportunity of teaching students for when they first come into our program about how when you're sharing something that, you know, how to help remove or do a buffer. And it's all about, does this communicate as effectively as it could, right? So we're able to break it down and try to remove it from the personal. That can help, especially if you're doing, you know, something more graphic design related or something where it's the intent is communicating something that's not from within, but something outward. So there's ways to help some of that. But on the flip side with like getting your master's in fine art, you have a critique, or at least this is my experience, where everyone is spending 2 hours on just your work, just tearing up every little bit, and you spent a month, so then it becomes a different level of personal. And this is why I hear so many that go to get a master's in photography or fine art or something, and then they can't even touch it. It's so, so intense of an experience that it almost unteaches the passion, whether it's music. You know, my wife has a similar kind of experience with what that did for her, and it's really tragic that society, that we just have these conforming ways of how things have done because they've been done in the past, and it's sad. So bringing it back down to, you know, how to teach it and create environments of where you can be vulnerable and what this is about, it's such a tricky thing to be creative, to share that. But then people are seeing it and thinking and experiencing their own things. And to hear those, it can be nerve-wracking and and terrifying. And then with this film, I feel like it's even more so because it's once I started learning more, so my son's diagnosis kind of started this journey, and I realized that, this is a minefield. So not only am I doing something out there creative that I want well received for how it's doing, but this could upset so many other people if I don't do this just right, or I'm not aware. And so you have the layers of how the heck is this going to be received? Or how is this going to be helpful for anybody else? Am I, you know, supporting the community in an appropriate way? So, anyways, layers of trickiness.
That would be really intimidating. I hadn't thought about that aspect of this is like films on autism have a like pretty mixed track record. And I love that you just like dove right in, diagnosed. Okay, let's make a film.
Well, back to the creativity thing. I had a sabbatical coming up. And so with my son's Kellen's diagnosis and then learning more of what this is actually, you know, we got the medical notes of, you know, what this is and ASD level one, but you know, they throw all these terms, by the way, you should go to autism speak and all these things. That's just straight from, you know, with the medical, model just, you know, predicates. And then, you know, digging deeper, I realized with how misunderstood he was that I needed to create something that helped bring up his voice, helped him bring up his advocacy, his self-advocacy for what people were not getting, not just like, oh, you didn't get it right, but he was being so misunderstood that we hear all these trauma events from later on for when people were misunderstood and this happened and this other thing happened. So how I need to create something that helps that elevates, you know, his experience and then also brings out all these others that are talking about this as well. And so when that sabbatical came up, I applied and it was so intense of a need to make something around this. And it's okay if I came from a place of discovery. I think that's probably helpful. That I was like, okay, if they don't support this, I'm not in the right place. Like I have to make this thing. And so the college did support it. They are wonderful in providing this full year of me being able to just make a film. And so, but it was a year of research and learning and really starting from just the medical model and just the ideas of how drastic it is to unpacking and realizing where my own journey is. So it's been from a point of needing to create and to do something creative with this, and also something that can support not just my son, but all the other people out there that are so misunderstood and feel it so deeply. So anyways, sorry.
No,
that's pretty powerful. And like thinking about it, right? Like you keep referencing like your learning journey and your experience as well. I don't know how old you are, Brett, but I found out I was autistic at 35. I'm 37. Megan, I think you found out at 37 potentially, if I got the age right. We have to start somewhere with our learning journey, right? Like, and if we're creating this documentary from that lens and that perspective of like going through that journey, you're certainly not alone in that, right? Where we are like, ooh, I have to learn some language. Ooh, I have to like step over something I said that I actually came across in a way that I didn't intend to. So like, there's a lot of unlearning and unpacking as well. And then you mentioned, you know, wanting to make this because of how misunderstood your son is. I say this all the time, but I think that feeling seen or understood is actually the way I receive love in a lot of ways because of how often I have felt misunderstood in my entire lifespan. And I think that is so freaking powerful.
Yeah, that's it. You know, especially for those that have the privilege of high masking in situations and all these things that for some where they have, especially with the history and the evolution, some people haven't continued to evolve with it or been up or keep up with the research or read the latest books. And so even the most well-experienced teachers in art, in whatever, have this one idea. And it is speaking of rigidity, it is a very rigid idea of what autism is and how it presents and what, you know, characteristics there are. And oh, that it's not that. So needed something had to push back. And this is the creative thing that came forward with that very deep need to share this experience that I do think that others or going through either late diagnosis or just maybe curious about themselves or family members or maybe went through the pipeline like I did where your child and then I'm like, oh, that's okay. Let's explore that. Or those that have experienced trauma because of what people assumed and how unkind so much of society can be. So how to do something creative from that's supportive, that's also very authentic and resonant with other people. So and filmmaking has been something that I took a break from, speaking of just creativity itself. It's been a lot of Photoshop for a number of years. So for me, with the technology, finally, I feel like at a place that can capture the the beauty that I see in a different way. Working with video early on, it couldn't transcend the screen in the same way. Mm-hmm. But now we have tools between slow motion and, you know, pan and tilt automation, all these things where I can do this whole interview where I have two camera setups. I'm doing this, and sorry, tech is also a special interest of mine. And so I like way nerd out on all of this. And so harnessing, you know, my special interest in creative ways, I feel like the tools have changed. And for me, that's been wonderful to be able to harness that and to do something at such a scale with such a small production team most of the time. So,
I think that's something that really stood out to me. So I've seen parts of your film. I also don't think we've even like shared the title of your film. I realized we did like we just dove into the context. I want to make sure I got this right. Divergent Gift Unboxing Autism.
Divergent Gift Unboxing Autism.
So I've seen clips of it, and something I shared with you, I've always, so you and I have something in common, Patrick. I don't know if you do this or not, but we both think in visuals. So I've always had a fantasy of being a filmmaker. I will never, that is for another life, because I don't have the tech background at all. But when I see a truth, or like there's some truth I want to convey, I'll have a like visual scene pop into my head. And when I watch parts of your documentary, there is something about how you like slow down and the angles, and I don't know technically what you're doing, but there's texture to it. There's an experience that you convey through your filmmaking that I was like, this is the stuff that's in my head when I'm like capturing a scene in my head. There's just something. And I mean, I don't think autistic people have the monopoly on this, but I think there is something about how autistic people create that can usher you into the experience in a really profound way. And I felt that when watching parts of your documentary, which is what it's like, yes, this is an autistic creation. I can tell, I can feel it.
I appreciate that. I'm so glad to hear that. And I've been analyzing, because I've been hearing that from others as well. And so one of the things that I'm trying to pick, but asking the why, right? More of a, why is that? So when I flew out to the UK to film Jordan James, the autistic photographer, which is, he would be a great one to have on as well for creativity. But him doing his sensory experience in nature in this beautiful morning light in his favorite woods with, you know, the sunrise, and him hyper-focusing and seeing him be just all in and on things that he just, that you could tell make him feel so good. So him doing that, I'm like, oh, that's exactly, I know that feeling. And then me hyper-focusing on capturing that and getting his breath particles and all these things and angles. Okay, let's get the squint on there so you can see. And so this hyper-focus of a hyper-focus and having this, like the infinite mirror kind of thing. And so my feeling is that that has lent itself to be part of the visual language of this in interviewing the subjects and what they're interested in, and in capturing and feeling that, and then trying to capture that. So it's been really amazing to make a film experiencing other people experiencing something that, I mean, this film basically is my coming home experience, right? And it's like someone doing something completely different, and yet I feel that, right? I get what they're doing, and mine is different, but I know that. And so trying to capture that and share that, I feel like it's personally important, but I think it's important for others to also see and feel that. So it's wonderful to bring it back around. It's wonderful to hear your experience of that. Thank you.
It makes me think of the concept of presence when you talk about like this dual deep focus. I was just, before we hopped on, I was reviewing, so positive psychology talks about creativity a lot, which I love that psychology is starting to talk about creativity. But one of the things creativity does is help us to be present. And it struck me when I first learned that, because I often talk about how hard it is for me to be present. And I'm autistic ADHD. So I think it's a combination. I think the autistic part, it struggles to be present because I'm often, unless it's a very ideal sensory environment, I'm often dissociated to some degree. And then ADHD just does not want to be present. But the one place where it's really easy for me to engage and to feel connected to myself, to feel connected to the moment, is through creativity. And so, yeah, that's a little bit of a rabbit trail, but I was just thinking about the connection between creativity and presence and how powerful that could be, particularly for those of us with brains for whom presence is hard.
Yeah, that is such an important point. I'm so glad you named that. And I think, you know, Megan and I have talked about this before, but why so many of us get so deeply engrossed in our work? Because when you're in that creative flow state, you feel so alive. And otherwise, you live in a body that can be kind of hellacious to be in, or in a brain that can't slow down. And I think it can just be such a struggle. So I know the labels often get thrown around of like perfectionism or workaholism or whatever. And it's like, no, this is very different than that. And I would love to continue to delineate between the two, because there's a major difference between like, I love working and I can't turn it off and I want to grind and hustle, versus like, I want to create and I want to feel present and I want to feel connected to what I'm putting out into the world. And I think that's where the magic happens.
Yeah, I have a couple thoughts that popped in with that. Is so true, especially getting into something. But there's also, for me, a flip side is I will get so into it, and having environment where, so at one level, like, you are completely present, like you are experiencing this and you're capturing that thing or doing whatever the thing, and it feels so wonderful to do that. And then for those who are on the outside, let's say I start doing a little iPad sketch at night and it's close to bedtime, where I'm supposed to be, you know, the parent and navigating the time and the routine. And if I start on that, to stop something that I am just so in that moment for is painful. And I go, so the disruption of creativity can be so intense that it's, we call it lizard brain. We just go straight into, you know, I just like, well, you're like, children, it's so intense that's, it literally takes my brain and creativity is there. And then what's left is this, you know, yeah, I still look like dad, but I'm not there. And so I can often get so engrossed into that hyper-focus, that it's, yeah, it could be rough for those around me, unless I pick an appropriate time of, you know, after bedtime or during work hours or some other thing. So being careful of when I unleash the creativity is something that I've found out that I have to be mindful of. Otherwise, it's not fair to everyone else.
I love this concept of disrupted creativity, because I think especially as parents, there's a lot of disrupted creativity that happens. So I have so many memories that rush over me. Oh, I had a thought. It flew away. Maybe it'll come back. Speaking of creativity. But
same with disruptive play, right? It's, you know, looking at, you know, if I disrupt my son when he's, you know, creating in his mind, I see the lizard brain come out and like, and I'm playing, you know, and snarl. Like, I understand that feeling so well. That's please continue. True. I'm sorry. You
know? we talk about like task and routine disruption too, right? So like if we're in that hyper focus or that creativity process and we're really feeling energized to be disrupted from it, my instant reaction is like irritability. Irritability, frustration. I'll be very short with whoever has brought me out of that. I was in that zone before we started recording today. I had to set a alarm here for 12:20 p.m. because I was like, if I do not do this, I'm going to look up and it's going to be 1 p.m. and I'm going to miss this interview. So finding those internal checks and balances and ways to accommodate yourself and your needs, super important. And I think we learn that as we go, as we learn more about ourselves and about our neurology too.
Yeah. I have a question for you both. For when you're in your own creative flow, how does environment affect either or both of you for when you find you're more creative, or how does that interact?
It's a great question. I feel like for me, it ebbs and flows. I think as I've gotten older, like I feel like the ideal sensory environment matters a little bit more. Although I'm also the person who like, and this is more classically autistic than ADHD, like can go to a coffee shop and get so hyper-focused that people are like, Megan, like where I, so it's kind of a both and. My personal ideal at this moment in life is like a weighted blanket. I have a moon pod, which is like a zero gravity beanbag chair, like beanie and the headphones with a song on repeat. And then sometimes like some incense, but I love to create kind of an ideal sensory environment where I can get really deeply into focus. I have a new puppy that is, it turns out, not the best environment for creativity. It leads to a lot of disrupted creativity.
For sure. Yeah.
What about you, Patrick?
I think for me, I've noticed like the more stimulation around me, and it has to be external. I can't create at my house. Like it's just borderline impossible. I don't have a puppy, but I have a neurotic Shih Tzu who just causes chaos 24/7. So it's like you could be in focus and all of a sudden he's losing his mind and you're like, okay, well that's done. I have to remove myself from this environment. I have to place myself in environments that, like Megan said, I could be in a coffee shop. It could be loud. It could be like kind of chaotic. I'm like drowning all of that out to the world. I create a lot in movement. I create a lot in nature. I create a lot when I'm traveling. When I'm traveling, I probably feel the most creative because they're just, it's new stimuli. It's new environment, yeah. New experience. It's like the excitement factor of all the things. And that's when my brain is like, oh yes, here are all these ideas. So it takes some effort to get to that place. But if I'm at my house, I'm doing like routine tasks that don't really do it for me, but they have to be done. So that's kind of the differentiation.
Yeah, routine versus creativity. Yeah, there's an interesting sort of battle there. For me, I've found that music, I didn't realize how much more music I do. The same songs, the same kind of something than other other people. I should have picked up on this earlier, but yeah, just getting something where either it's headphones, but that hyper-focus really does become a studio, a creative studio in a sense of that if you're really in that flow and have the right, at least for me, the right sensory things with music or something where you can just really hone in on it. I feel like I could kind of take it anywhere and variety sometimes is helpful. Different environments, as long as I can get into that flow. But it's interesting because I know for some people they have to be in just their studio or just this. And Megan, Anna, what you're saying of where you can, you know, where things just sort of zone out or at least aren't as focused in the same way as what we're creating. That's it's an interesting thing. And for students, I've noticed this accommodating other people's way of making in a space communally has been interesting as well, because some have to have their own ears. Some, you know, really ask like, can the lights be down? Or, hey, can I go to this other room? And so it's so personalized. Anyways, I was just curious. Thank you.
No, I love that question. Yeah. Yeah, my spouse, before we knew I was autistic, would call it the vortex, because I would like get into the zone and like not hear the kids and not hear and that. I hadn't thought about this till you talked, Patrick, but movement. I actually used to, back when I was doing my doctoral training, I had access to a basketball court. And so my favorite thing would be to go just shoot hoops repetitively, listen to the same song on repeat. And I wrote a lot of articles. I was writing a book at the time and I wrote a lot of my book that way. I'd write it in my head and then I'd actually write it. And there's some research around this, that movement is one of the things that actually really supports ideation and creativity. Yeah. I need more of that. The pandemic has just messed with everything.
No. Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, you've Patrick.
Megan, like when you've gone for walks around your neighborhood, maybe it was before you moved actually to your new place, but that was very helpful and just being able to get out into space. And I think even like just generic movement for me, it doesn't even have to be something significant like going to play soccer. It can just be going for a walk, like, because it allows my body to finally get back into my body. And I'm like, oh, okay, that's what it's like to put pressure on my feet. That's what it's like to like hear sounds that are not indoors or in my television. Like, my wife and I have a verbal agreement that I have to leave the house once a day, because there will be days where she's like, have you left the house this week? And I'm like, isn't it Monday? And she's like, it's Friday. You know, it's Friday. Every time I come home, you're sitting in the dark on doing something on the computer. I'm like, okay. So it's a good reminder for me to be like, break that focus, break that monotony, break that routine up, and just like get out and get into that space where I can start thinking differently.
Yeah, that's really important. I know that, but I don't practice it as much as I should. I have the routine. So this is interesting, the battle routine versus, you know, places that are more, I don't know, really tease out the creativity. I have the spot in the couch where I go, and then I am just, you know, I start vortexing. I'm going to so use that. I have my vortex space that's very effective for me. And then the family's like, oh no, there's that vortexing happening in the same spot there. But yeah, I will go to the point of, you know, sitting 2 hours, 3 hours, just being so on a screen. And that's where my creative tools are often enough. Sure. But yeah, my wife will come over and say, when's the last time you stood up? Yeah. Okay. All right. I'll go do the dishes or something, I guess. But
that's that experience, right? Of like, I'll be sitting there in the vortex, be like, I have to pee. And I'll be telling myself that for like an hour. But like,
yes.
Just cannot get myself to.
Yeah.
And your brain is like doing that thing where it's like, I have to pee. You should get up and go to the bathroom. Yeah. You should get up and go to the bathroom. But then you keep doing whatever you're doing and you're like, get out of here. Just like, don't bother me with this right now. An hour later on. Oh shit. It's a borderline UTI time.
Time to repent. Okay. So this is not a gross tangent, but similar. But when I remember taking one of the psychology classes of, you know, back in undergrad, and, you know, of always taking care of your bodily needs. So that is something, if there's any, you know, have to go to the bathroom or anything else, I found that I can be way more productive, really making sure that I am on that. And then I can dive even deeper into the vortex. So anyways, I've trained myself from that. Whenever I have that thing like, oh, I bet I'm going to be like 20 times more effective if I just like do this now. So I have a motivation is to re-enter the vortex. So
I love that that's what motivates you to take care of body needs, is like, it means a deeper, longer vortex.
Yeah. Right? Who
doesn't? Experiencing. It's, it's more creativity. Yeah.
Yeah. The body is just something, you know, it moves the brain around, but the brain needs to be here and doing this thing. So, love the language that's coming out of this. Return to the vortex. I'm so glad that I get to be around others that are going to college because they have that same sort of creative impulse and need. And so that's just been really wonderful as a career choice, is being able to immerse and help guide other people through their own process and know, you know, when that person's experiencing it. And it's interesting, back to what you were saying, Patrick, with movement. So for my son, it is about pacing. So he sees in 3D, and he's got a physics engine that operates and all these really cool things. But for him, he either has to be bouncing on a yoga ball. Oh yeah, pandemic taught him to be Olympic level. They had Olympics for yoga ball bouncing and tricks and all those things. He would gold medalist all the way. So anyways, he has to be doing things, and he'll be talking about a game idea or a monster, the creation that we then apply creative dad to then make. Right. So we collaborate in that way. But for him, movement is intrinsic to creating. So
yes, I love that. Megan and I have talked about this, and I'm sure a lot of people can relate, but like, as catastrophic, and I don't want to minimize it, as COVID has been, it's been so good for me in so many ways. Like, I get to work online. I get to do everything virtually. I don't have to be in person if I don't want to be. I know I have the privilege to do that, but it's just been transformative in that way, where I'm like, I feel more creative now than I've ever been in my life over the last 3 or 4 years, honestly.
So I have an interesting story to share as the, you know, having to teach, switch everything to Zoom. So for me, there was a part of me that, yeah, I'm like, this is, I love it. So I've always taught on video, right? I've figured out how to be expressive within a frame and how to be, make content interesting. And so when everything switched over to that, I'm like, oh, this is amazing. I get to literally teach to this. And so for some students, that was like, okay, for some, it was like, this is the worst. I need to be in person. Otherwise I cannot get this content. But then there was a demographic of students that this was their, like, college can be this. I can learn in my own environment with my lizard on my shoulder. This is like, I saw these students that were, you know, now I can apply more knowledge that I've, you know, have. But there's this whole fairly large number of our student body that, you know, being remote, it opened them up. They could collaborate differently. They could be creative. They were excited in different ways. And so, yeah, that's interesting. What social, how much in a forced social environment for many can really, talking about sensory, you can't get past that to get in the vortex or do anything creative or productive.
Absolutely. So
that was interesting to experience with the pandemic.
Well, it was interesting to me as a therapist. Like, I would be seeing clients virtually and from a completely different perspective. And like, clients who would do sessions in their cars because that was the only private space they had. But I got to see like their inner world in a way I never would have seen if they came in and sat on the couch. Yeah. Because like,
yeah,
I'm like, oh, why do you have 20 iPhone boxes in your car? Which then leads to like conversations about neurodivergence. And then it leads to like, oh, I'm going to go get tested. And then it's like, oh, I'm autistic. And now I see the world through a different lens. That never would have happened had that person come in and sat across from me for 50-minute sessions and in person in that way. It was just illuminating in so many different ways for me.
Yeah. It's like a safe way to not have someone try to peel off your mask, but to let more, you know, students were in their environments, you know, they're animals, they're little buddies that they feel so strong, you know, come right in, and then talking about these things, having these points that in a classroom environment were not an accessible social node to then, you know, there's no access to any kind of, you know, camaraderie or learning about each other. But with the home, it was like, oh yeah, this is everything. This is my sabbatical office, but imagining these students, that was an important part that really opened up more connection and a lot of other things. It was like this lubricant that was so missing, being extracted from that environment and put into this alien world of, we have chairs and computers and a screen and now interact. We've got 5 minutes, you know.
Yep, for sure.
Yeah, there's so many interesting things that came out of the pandemic. Lots of not good, but there are some amazing things like Olympic level yoga ball. So,
listen, and movement, yeah, this not happened. I don't think the three of us are sitting here talking about this conversation like this. So I just think that so many cool things get to happen because we get to connect with people virtually too.
Yeah.
Like Megan and I have never met in person, but I feel like Megan's one of the closest people I have in my life on a pretty routine basis. And we've never actually met. It's just pretty cool.
I love the phrase.
Please go for it. Yeah.
I love the phrase mixed emotions. And I'm noticing myself having so many mixed emotions to this conversation. Cause I'm the same in that the pandemic opened up a new experience of life. And like, I wouldn't have the life I have. I have no idea what my life would look like, but I agree. Like there's things that I love about my life I want to have, but COVID itself has taken so much from my body, from my daughter. That I have such mixed emotions about this.
Totally.
And it's the one thing, like when I'm, because I can get into spirals about like, what if I hadn't gone to that conference? What if I hadn't gotten infected so early? And then I'm like, okay. And I like the life I have right now. Yeah. And living with this is incredibly, incredibly hard.
Yeah, it's really one of those diametrically opposing things that is a both and situation so often, right? Like we're like, look at all this good that came because of look at all this devastation, and both can happen and coexist together. And that's always challenging to hold up, especially when it impacts you so physically too, like with long COVID that you're experiencing. Yeah. I feel for you. I don't being sick well, and I just chronic fatigue and the struggle and the exhaustion and the brain fog would,
it adds a whole other layer of like, okay, what should I say and not say? Will my colleagues watch this or not? I was the last holdout for mask every single place, and it was interesting what relationships, how those evolved, what new ones came out of this, which ones were like, oh, that's not as compatible with what, I need, my family needs. Looking at the student side, it was hard. I think what it did bring about that was, or at least from my experience and my colleagues, is an increase in empathy and grace, which I think society so needed a really big volume boost of. So in that case where if someone was sick or whatever was happening, I feel like, at least in my class, like, okay, we are being about adaptive. I will do everything I can to make sure you're, caught up. And I feel like a lot of people, students, gave me more grace in trying to make it a better place for them. So on the social side, I'm thankful that I feel like there was at least a better awareness and care for one another in some ways. But that was also felt like only in certain environments. So it was these pockets of empathetic, little mini micro communities. Yeah, that's a whole other topic. But bringing it back to the creativity, that was helpful in a really, really hard time, especially at the beginning where there was so much new. The environment of it being a safe place to make and to keep on trying is so important as we're all making this. So to bring it back even further with the film and getting to do the sneak peek for the community, that also had much of the same feels like, oh, this is important for others. This really matters, and this is doing good. I'm going to keep doing this. This is where it's at. It's a lot of mixed, definitely mixed emotions and mixed feelings from all of it.
Mixed emotions. It's a good word. It's a word that helps you hold a paradox, which I love paradox. Yeah. Speaking of your film, and I don't know. I mean, I know you're still in production. Do you have a timeline some people have asked me, because I've been talking about your film, of when this will be out for the world?
Yeah. sorry, I'm laughing because I'm trying to go, okay, how do I, make the spiral very aerodynamic? I don't know. I have more gravity in the middle. So I have this year-long sabbatical to do basically as much as I possibly can, creative side, passion-wise, advocacy, to create the greatest impact I possibly can. So that's like, in my mind, that's what I'm doing. So as part of that, there's where my sabbatical ends, where I start teaching, which is this coming fall. And we're shifting into now post-production. So I filmed 11 interviews, and, incredible subjects that, even if all I did was put together what these, it's just incredible. Basically, I had my private, series of TED Talks, right? Of, Mornike, you have Eric Garcia, all these just phenomenal figures in there. So even if I just edit all of what they have, it should be done and it should be something powerful by fall. What I want to do that's taking more time and tricky is raising money to bring in other collaborators, in this case, animators and illustrators and other creatives, because I know it can be, with more of a community, it can elevate. It can be something even more powerful. I can do a lot, right? I can animate, I can do all these things, but I've learned just because I can do all these things isn't translate always to I should do all these things. So trying to bring in more collaborators is great in that people are very excited and want to. What's not great is fundraising to make sure that they have the support for being part of this like I do, right? I have this privilege where, you know, I've put my time in as a college professor, sabbatical, it is supported. You know, I can just do the most I can every day. So the part that's taking longer is fundraising and getting enough support to hire this neurodivergent team of artists and animators to elevate it to the next level. So every time that I have to write an email, and that's for me, that is not a fill my cup kind of activity.
That sounds terrible.
So, and I have to do a lot of networking, and I love who I've been able to connect with. But that energy when I'm in this box that doesn't have a window, and I'm thankful for this office with all the things there, mixed emotions, that is hard to sustain versus bring it back to point when I get to create or animate, right? Then I could be up to midnight every single night and more energized. So back to the point, it hopefully will be released this fall. It kind of depends on how much fundraising and how much support we can get from the community or from, if there's an organization where I'm in talks right now with some folks, which will be actually later today. So if there can be funding, that will help make it get done by this fall. If it needs to go a little bit longer, then it has to. So again, it's a mixed answer for that. My goal is to have it all done before I go back to teaching, because that's when my time commitment just goes to the students and to having a really great program. So there's the answer. We need more funds raised to get through this next part. So
perfect segue. Where can people find that fundraiser?
I'm so glad. So this being, by the community, for the community, and then hopefully we can get more audience beyond the community. So we have the website, thedivergentgift.com. That's it. Yep. There is a little donate link for people that we have a fiscal nonprofit, again, dyslexic, nonprofit fiscal sponsorship through the Portland Art Museum and Center for the Untold Tomorrow. Pam Cut, there we go. So donations are tax deductible. It's amazing with the partnerships that we have. We're working with the B Corp, Funnelbox, who's incredible partners. So that website, if nothing else, will get you to where you can learn more about it and see the trailer. And if you want to see the 24-minute sneak peek, as long as you don't post anywhere, you can email me, and I'm happy to maybe share the little sneak peek with others. So thedivergentgift.com. And then that's probably the easiest way to find the donation link.
And then I'll put this in the show notes as well as like an extra way. So I think people should donate directly. Absolutely. And then an extra thing people could do if they want. I always give 10% of my proceeds from my shop to various autistic initiatives. So for January and February, that's been directed to the film. But I have a coupon code that will stay active until you're done fundraising. That for our listeners, that will give you, it gives you 25% off as listeners. And then 20% of the proceeds will go to the film. So we'll put that in the show notes as well. So that's another way that people can support the film, is if they've been wanting one of the NeuroDivergent Insights workbooks, they can do that.
That's your chance. Thank you, Megan. Amazing. Yeah. I'm just very thankful.
Honestly, I'm so excited. Like, I think part of what is shifting in how, like, with more autistic people speaking about autism, is it's shifting from a narrative of this is a terrible, horrible thing that happens to families, to something that we can take pride in, that we can celebrate autistic culture. And I feel like your film really embodies a celebration of autistic culture, especially by the fact you're bringing in autistic like animators and artists, and it's by the autistic community. And I'm so excited about this, because I think having more things in the world that highlight autistic creativity and that give people something to feel proud of like, yes, I'm part of this community, I'm part of this culture, I think is so powerful. So I'm really, really excited to see this whenever it's released.
So Patrick, I'll send you the sneak peek too. So
thank you very much.
I'm very excited to just keep doing this. Again, it has to be talking again full circle there with the creativity. This film has to be out in the world. Like I need this to be from here out there. So I appreciate everyone that feels that and has that a similar need. And if I can use my creativity and my skills and everything that I do and just love doing to help, you know, get this out there, that is just the coolest thing that, you know, aside from my son, I've ever, you know, helped be part of.
Thank you so much for coming on and having this conversation. It was a lot of fun and really enjoyed this, really learned a lot. And I hope this was helpful for everyone that's listening. And all of Brett's information will be in the show notes as well, and all of Megan's information that she just listed, so everyone has easy access to donate, to purchase workbooks that will also go towards donations. So lots of great ways to get involved. And I'm really excited for you. Congrats on this. It sounds amazing.
We'll see. Thank you so much again for having me, both of you. This has been really wonderful. So I'm so glad I got to, connect with more of the community. It's been such a cool thing as part of this project. So I'm glad it led me to you both. Thank you.
Thank you. And to everyone listening to the Divergent Conversations podcast, new episodes are on every single Friday on all major platforms and YouTube. Like, download, subscribe, and share. We'll see you next week.
As you may know from listening to our podcast, I've been working on a book, Self-Care for Autistic People, and I'm excited to announce it's out this month, both in physical form and as an audiobook. As a celebration of its release, I'd like to share some excerpts from the audiobook edition with you, our podcast listeners. The book is designed as a book you can pick up for brief, easy 5-minute reads with over 100 different entries that introduce you to practices for incorporating self-care. You can find the audiobook wherever audiobooks are sold, available on March 19th. Enjoy. Here's an excerpt from the audiobook edition of Self-Care for Autistic People that touches on how to celebrate your special interests.
My brain works in self-contained worlds that I refer to as ecosystems. I see connections, links, patterns, and relations in everything. When I become passionate about something, I must understand it in its entirety. This is what I call the special interest ecosystem. This might sound familiar to you because approaching interests in this deep way is actually a common trait of autistic people. My special interest ecosystem has become a crucial part of my self-care routine. When I'm feeling overwhelmed or stressed, I turn to my interests for comfort and grounding because they provide a sense of stability and familiarity. Your interests not only are deeply integrated into your identity, but also can be incredibly soothing. They can help you reduce stress, emotionally regulate, and access a wellspring of energy to help you feel more grounded. You can find comfort and safety in the deep understanding you have about your areas of interest. As a bonus, connecting with other people about your areas of interest is a powerful way to forge and strengthen connections and relationships. However, many autistic people resist leaning into their special interests. Society often views these interests as abnormal or obsessive, which can lead to internalized shame and embarrassment. This mindset can make it challenging to embrace the power of your special interest energy for self-soothing. Try flipping the script on any negative associations you may have with your interests and celebrate them instead. After all, the energy behind special interests can drive innovation, creativity, and social change. Many groundbreaking inventions and movements have come from people deeply passionate about particular subjects. For example, Greta Thunberg's interest in environmental justice has ignited a spark within millions, inspiring them to rally against the threat of climate collapse. Similarly, Steve Jobs, co-founder of Apple, was known for his obsession with the convergence of technology and design, which reshaped the technological landscape. Note, while Jobs exhibited numerous autistic traits, there is no definitive evidence to confirm he was autistic. Because interests and identity are so interwoven for autistic people, embracing your interests is a form of embracing your identity. You will cultivate a strong sense of self through your interests, making them a foundational part of your mental self-care. To integrate special interests into self-care, consider reserving specific time for delving into your passions, using your interests as emotional regulation tools, weaving your hobbies into daily activities, or leveraging them to cultivate social connections. See what resonates with you. The key is to not be ashamed of your level of interest. By embracing these interests and incorporating them into your self-care routine, you can find a sense of stability and familiarity in a world that often feels overwhelming and unpredictable.
Many autistic people apologize for merely existing, and so I definitely needed an entry on how to curtail the apology reflex. Here's an excerpt from that portion of the book.
Do you habitually apologize, even when others bump into you or when you're simply asking for clarification? Does this apology reflex manifest everywhere in your life? Many autistic people tend to apologize excessively. It's as if we feel compelled to apologize for our mere existence. Before realizing I was autistic and consciously addressing this issue, I found myself apologizing relentlessly. I felt a constant need to justify my existence by being excessively accommodating. Whenever my presence seemed to cause any inconvenience, regardless of fault, an apology would follow. Due to our efforts to fit into a neurotypical society and the shame we experience when we are unable to do so, many of us have become accustomed to apologizing for simply taking up space. While expressing regret when you genuinely hurt someone or err is important, continually apologizing for merely existing needs reassessment. This reflex reinforces a negative self-narrative of being a burden or an inconvenience, leading to feelings of neurodivergent shame and low self-esteem, and adversely affecting our emotional health. To break free from the apology reflex, try a new response. Next time someone inadvertently bumps into you, or the reverse, use phrases like, "excuse me," or "pardon me," rather than automatically saying, "I'm sorry." Adjusting your language helps you shift away from constant self-deprecation and fosters a more affirming sense of self. Over time, you can learn to stop apologizing for everything and begin to cultivate a more positive and confident self-image.